Good afternoon. The Health and Human Services Finance Division will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, so we're going to wait for that. We'll wait to approve the minutes. But as we begin here, Representative Grunhagen wanted to make a statement, so I'm going to give the floor to him for a moment and let him go ahead and do that. Representative Grunhagen.
I prefer to wait till a few more members are here. That's okay.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, you know, the meeting has started. If members are late, I can't really control that, but we're going to start with our presentation when you're done. So
okay.
If you want to go ahead, members are kind of drifting in.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Lutling. And, the comment I wanted to make from yesterday's presentation, I had a opportunity to talk to an oral surgeon here in St. Paul, actually. He just practices right across the river. He gave me permission to mention his name, and he wanted to give a little input into HHS finance and the upcoming session. One thing, his name is Dr. Metling. He, again, practices just across the river here, right in St. Paul. He takes Medicaid patients, so he serves Medicaid patients from Rochester, Duluth, and all across the state. Obviously, there's a shortage in that area, but he's one of the ones who takes them. He's been practicing for a long time, over 30 years, and I had a chance to visit with him. I was there to, not for oral surgery, but to on another issue. And one of the things he said is that he has three children. They all entered the medical field, and they were all educated primarily in Minnesota, and they've all left Minnesota to practice medicine in some other state. And he's leaving very soon to another state to practice with his son. So he's paid $40,000 in provider tax last year. And he just said that between the regulations, mandates, taxes, and the provider tax, he thinks Minnesota doesn't want him to be here anymore. So I do think that we need to look at both sides of the coin here in terms of the laws, regulations, and mandates that we pass onto the medical community, because some of the results is we're actually chasing good providers out of the state. I know in the rural area we're having a crisis of medical doctors and access. Is government regulations, taxes, and mandates a part of that problem? And if so, I think we should look at that. This is my final comment. An interesting statistic, I think, would be to check with the University of Minnesota, a medical school, and find out how many educated medical professionals we have through the school that actually locate in Minnesota, or do they go somewhere else to practice? And if government laws, mandates, and regulations and taxes are a big part of that problem, I think we have to be very careful going forward. We can pass a lot of feel-good legislation, but if the result is we're discouraging providers and actually helping them leave the state or not practice here anymore, I think that should be a big concern to all of us. He said you could contact him and talk to him if you want. I didn't ask him if he'd testify in front of the committee, but if the committee's interested, I'd go back and ask him to come and testify. And again, he gave me permission to share this information. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And just a couple responses to that. We're going to be looking at a lot of things this year, but one of the things I would point out is that we've had the provider tax in place for over 25 years. So, this is not a new thing. And if it's caused people to leave, I think we would have seen that. We've seen in many times we've had reports about what makes people come to Minnesota, what makes them leave. And I would say that the weather probably figures kind of high in there, especially as people get older. Sometimes they like to retire to warmer places. Many times, however, I meet people who are coming back to retire here because we have good services. So I think that's kind of an important factor as well. The other thing I just would note is that while I really am welcoming every member of this committee to engage in trying to find solutions to the problems that we face. And I have appreciated a lot of your good questions and constructive comments. I just want to remind people that we just took over this committee. The Republicans have been in charge of this committee for 4 years. And so, you know, if there were solutions to be found, I think the Republicans have had ample opportunity, and I haven't, frankly, seen a lot of them, and certainly a lot that work. So while we're open to differences, we understand that different members of our state, residents of our state have different philosophies on things, and we want to bring all of those differences to the table. I think it'll be important to try to work off a common set of facts. And so I'm making an attempt here to provide those facts as we go along, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of opportunities to discuss these issues. So thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, ma'am.
So we do have a quorum. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Neuer moves to approve the minutes of January 23rd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. So today we are going to hear from a program, I guess it's called Results First. And I think they will explain to you kind of how they came about and what their mission is. But before they do that, I just wanted to set the stage a little bit about one of the big reasons that I've asked them to come and present to us today. This the existence of this office or program, I'm not sure what they call themselves, they're a division of MMB here in the state. And This was a kind of a project that was initially brought as legislation by Representative Mack, who was chairing the policy committee. I was very much behind that because I had found out about this effort some time before that. So it's a bipartisan effort to fund a project to help legislators make better decisions, better evidence-based decisions. And they're going to explain how they work and what they have available. And I want members to pay attention to this. I believe that Representative Schumacher's committee did this as well, had a presentation from them.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to kind of raise their profile again this year, because as members bring forward proposals to this committee, I would like to ask members to utilize Results First. And I'm going to be looking for that. So when you bring forward some, you'll see they'll explain to you what they do. But I want you to pay attention, because I'm going to be asking you to utilize them to the extent possible to help this committee make decisions. And so when we bring forward proposals, I'd like members to also bring us whatever Results First has to say about that topic. That's not to say that we will follow slavishly whatever they have or don't have, or that if they don't have evidence for something that we won't do it. But I do think that we need to at least know what they've got, and I think in that way we can make better use of this thing that we are paying for as a state, and that I think will help us ultimately make better decisions, and partly maybe it'll help them figure out as we go along what things they need to be focusing on as well. So with that, I'm going to invite them to come down and introduce themselves and give us their presentation. And I did not go through their presentation. I don't know exactly what they're going to say, but I hope that they will kind of begin by telling us how this office came into existence in Minnesota, kind of what the background is here, so we all kind of come up to speed on that. So welcome to the committee, and who's going to go first here?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Kramer.
My name is Laura Kramer, and I am with Minnesota Management and Budget.
My name is Weston Merrick, and I'm also with Minnesota Management and Budget.
So thank you very much for giving us the opportunity today to talk to you about Results First and evidence and policymaking and what that looks like. As you noted, Madam Chair, we are part of Minnesota Management and Budget, and we are within the Budget Division in a team called Results Management. So our goal overall is really to help the decision-making process be informed with data and research so that you all have some of the tools to understand what science is saying about the different kinds of proposals and policy changes that you're looking at. We are nonpartisan staff, and we have a strong ethos of objectivity and transparency in our work. That's part of why we wanted to be here today, to talk about what we're doing, how we do it. And sometimes we joke that some of the best work we do is being able to articulate what we're doing and what we're not doing. So we're also very aware of where evidence is great and where sometimes it has pitfalls also. Policymakers, legislators, yourselves often want to fund programs that produce desired outcomes, right? And anecdotes and assumptions about what works can be widespread. But increasingly, scientific evidence is also available to indicate whether a given program or policy can produce desired results. So today we're going to provide some high-level information to talk about what resources you have available to figure out what science is saying about something in particular. And I'll say now and sort of throughout the presentation that we look forward to being able to work with you to provide information as you might have questions both today and into the future. So what we'll do today is spend a little bit of time giving you kind of a broad overview of what Results First actually is. Then we'll provide some context on how we define evidence and what we mean when we're talking about evidence and rigorous research. We'll give you a little bit of insight into what a Results First project looks like, what some of our outputs and tools are for you, and then give just sort of a broader sense of what tools are available to find evidence-based information. And also give you a sort of an update on what we know about where evidence-based programs and services are being used throughout the state. So Minnesota's Results First initiative, as Chair Liebling said, was brought to Minnesota in 2015. So the legislature directed MMB to work with the Pew and MacArthur Foundation framework, and that was the inception of this our small team over at MMB. So since then, Minnesota has been recognized for its work in this space. The Pew Foundation has called Minnesota number 3 in the country for using evidence in policy, which is a wonderful distinction. However, when you looked at the way they scored states, we still have a very long way to go. So I say that because a lot of states are thinking about how to bring evidence into the policymaking process, and there's some great ideas out there. But it's still a work in progress. So people are just sort of digging into this and figuring out what works. And so we're looking forward to being able to do that with you. So broadly speaking, Results First is really an initiative in which we try to work with our partners, our county partners, tribal partners, other state agencies, to understand what services the state is funding in any particular program area. So when we talk about program areas, in the initial legislation, we were directed to look at human services and corrections. So we have largely stuck within that space, looking at things like adult and children's mental health, adult and juvenile justice. We've looked at substance use disorder, child welfare also. So really thinking about what are we funding, what is out there? Because oftentimes this can get really fragmented in our county delegated system. Once we know what's out there, we want to understand what the research says about those things. So we do a lot of work to look at existing research to see whether that program or policy has been shown to be effective, either in Minnesota or if national research has shown it to be effective in another state. And once we know that, we also do a subset of programs and conduct an actual benefit cost analysis, where we spend a lot of time thinking about the cost to deliver that program in Minnesota and what benefits we might anticipate recipients showing over time, how their outcomes might change over time. Overall, our goal is to produce evidence-based information that's understood, trusted, and used by you and others who are making decisions. And so we work really hard and I think are very diligent in terms of identifying what's out there and trying to put together resources that, while wonky at times, are also very thorough in an attempt to really synthesize what can be a very large base of information out there into something that is more context-specific to Minnesota. So as I mentioned, we have, since 2015, we've conducted full program reviews in adult mental health, adult criminal justice, in substance use, both prevention and treatment for adults and youth, juvenile justice, child welfare, and higher education. We currently have projects underway in children's mental health, which Weston will speak to, will be released next week, actually, and then also in health and prevention. So much of our work is guided by an advisory committee that includes members from the legislative branch. Representative Loeffler has served on that, and Representative O'Neill has also served on that in the past. We have representatives from the executive branch, tribal representation, the judicial branch, and then also county partners. And as I said, in each project, we're forming pretty strong relationships with different community groups and providers because we don't have the knowledge necessarily of everything that's happening out there. That really comes from what people are telling us is going on. And so that's a large part of our work, is sort of that back and forth to understand what's happening so that we can bring that information forward to you. So defining evidence. So sort of a fun fact, or I think fun fact, if you were to Google evidence-based policy, you would get about 2.4 million results, okay? So it's important for us to get some boundaries around what do we mean when we say evidence-based policy. What is it, right? Because it's easy to come up and say, I have this proposal and it's evidence-based. Well, what does that mean? What kind of evidence was collected? Was it shown to work here? Was it shown to work somewhere else? Did you just get a series of people who told you it worked? And so there's a lot of different types of evidence. And so some of what we want to talk about is sort of how we view research and kind of the bar that we've set through the Results First Initiative for really high quality research. And we're looking at research that really can show that a program actually caused an outcome to change. So I'll get into this a little bit and kind of that difference between correlation and causation. And then we'll also talk about how within Results First, we're defining evidence-based. So as I said, science is really important because measuring the impact of a program isn't necessarily straightforward. At the outset, you might have somebody experiencing poor outcomes. They receive a program or some type of intervention, and they're better afterward. So you would say, that program worked. And it could have. And we would say it would have that if they hadn't received the program and they were still worse off. However, what if they hadn't received the program and they would have been even better off? Right, then we would say that that program actually harmed them, that absent it, they could have done better. And it's really hard to know whether or not that's occurring unless you're doing some scientific research to be able to look into what happened before, what happened after, for those who were part of the program and those who weren't. Oops. Go back one there. So the way that we get at this is really through two different kinds of research methods. And you may have heard of some of these before, but we talk a lot about random control trials and quasi-experimental designs. So I promise I won't spend too much time here because this is where it can get really into the weeds for those of you who may not have a passion for this. But essentially, these are two different ways to identify, was a program effective? And you can isolate because that program actually did something, not because maybe the person was also experiencing some other changes in their life. And something that we often hear random control trials talked about as sort of the gold standard of research, and it really came out of a clinical and medical design where you have some people who receive treatment and some people who receive treatment as usual. And that's great. I think what we've seen over the last 10, 15, 20 years is that social science has also come a really long way in terms of its ability to use what we call quasi-experimental designs. And these are really just some statistical tools to create what we call an artificial control group. So you don't necessarily need to have a group of people who didn't receive something. Instead, you can take advantage of natural experiments like wait lists, like lotteries, like phased rollouts, in order to do some research and understand if that program really did have an impact. And we know that we see those things all of the time, particularly with limited resources. So that can be a tool that can be really helpful in terms of building out more research. So now that we've talked a little bit about what the research is, I want to talk about how we define it at MMB. So one of the things we talk about are levels of evidence. So we come up with these designations called proven effective, promising, theory-based, then we have mixed effects, no effect, and proven harmful. And essentially, these are a way for us to look at a policy or a program intervention, assess the evidence, and say, how effective is that program being based on this type of research? So proven effective is the highest rating that we assign. And in this scenario, what we're looking for is more than one of those random control trial or quasi-experimental design, so that really high bar of research, so more than one of those studies has shown a positive impact on at least one outcome. So if we've seen that for a program, then we're going to say that's something that's been proven to be effective. It's been researched more than once. And then if you kind of come down a level, we have a promising designation. And that's where we'd typically see one really high quality study having taken place on a particular program. So it looks like it's having really good outcomes. We're seeing good things, but it hasn't been replicated. And so that's an important distinction, is sort of that replication. And then we also have a designation called theory-based. And this is what we see a lot of different programs in, and it's not intended to be pejorative in any way, but simply to say there's not yet research that meets that quasi-experimental design or random control trial that has taken place on that program. So we're not able to say definitively that program caused A or B to happen. So that's really what theory-based means. Now, oftentimes, those are the kinds of programs that might go through an evaluation over time and could certainly move into one of these categories as, you know, as the research comes out. As I noted, we also have designations for mixed effects, no effect, and proven harmful. We don't tend to see this quite as often, but it certainly does arise where a program's been shown not to be any better than having not had treatment at all. Or there are those limited circumstances where it's been proven harmful. So the recipient was better off not having anything happen. Now, before we sort of dive into more, I do want to take a moment here and talk about culture and evidence-based practices. And I think it's really important to recognize the relationship here, because considering culture in the way that different policies and programs are implemented and researched can be challenging. And oftentimes, a frequent and very fair critique about some of these high-quality research designs is that they're not necessarily taking into account different cultural considerations, or that type of research is not something that has been done very widespread in certain populations. And so oftentimes we hear sort of this dichotomy arise of, well, there's culturally appropriate programs or policies, and then there's evidence-based programs or policies. And part of what we just want to convey is that we do see that there's some overlap in that, and that as we think about, you know, everybody's worldview, cultural perspective, and cultural competence, those are things that can be part of any intervention at any time and should be. And those are always going to inform what's going on. Then there's what we would sort of consider culture-informed practices. And these are things that may come out of the American Indian community, for example, where based on history and their own spiritual healing, there is an intervention that is very personal to their community and their experience, and that's really informed by their culture. And there's also evidence-based practices that might be adapted to really take into account somebody's own personal preferences, their culture, their language, all kinds of different things. And evidence can play a part in, obviously, the evidence-based practices and the culturally informed practices. But we also recognize that there's a set of things for which this kind of research oftentimes is not appropriate or would be too intrusive just based on the historical context. So just wanted to make sure that we noted that kind of before we dive into what some of our projects actually look like. So Weston's just going to take a moment, now that we've kind of defined all of these different kinds of evidence, to say what do we actually do with results first, and then we'll kind of come back to the tools that you can use as you go out and look for evidence.
Thank you, Laura. Yeah, first part of the presentation really giving that grounding of why we define certain evidence in the way that we do. Lots of evidence out there. Why do we use this?
Would you just say your name again for the record?
My name is Weston Merrick.
Thank you.
Why we do that? Why do we define evidence the way we do? Last half of the conversation is going to be purely about tools that we can give you for you to be able to do this quickly and easily as possible. This part of the presentation, we just want to ground it in a programmatic area that we do. As Laura mentioned, we've done six programmatic areas in the last 3 years. We have one that's going to be released next week. That's Children's Mental Health. So you all are going to be some of the first to see some of those early results. And we just want to make it very tangible, the sort of evidence that we have, what that means, and what that means in a programmatic area. So in Children's Mental Health, we spent 10 months working with DHS, MDH, MDE, tribal nations, counties, providers, understanding what are the things, what are the services, practices, programs that we do to help children and families that are experiencing mental health conditions. What are those physical activities? For the purposes of this project, we define that continuum as these kind of these early assessments that we do to identify kids that may have early symptoms of mental illness, all the way to those deep end services, right? Our residential treatments, our PRTFs, our hospitalization settings. We looked across that entire continuum, and we found 68 discrete things that we are doing right now, publicly funded, across the state. Those things, and I use the word things, we use the word services a lot as a broad category, but again, practices, therapies, treatments, community supports, aftercare, all of these different activities that we may be doing to help kids and their families. Of those 68 services, we found 44% of them were evidence-based, meaning they had at least one impact evaluation that showed that that service was generating positive outcomes for clients. A little more than half of the services are theory-based, meaning we do not yet have an impact evaluation that tells us whether this is generating positive impacts for those kids. Seven programmatic areas, I'd say 44% is a little bit above average in terms of the percent that is evidence-based compared to the other programmatic areas. And this comes to Laura's point of this medical model, where the medical tradition is just very familiar with the idea of having a treatment group and a treatment as usual group and comparing the two over time. Places like Children's Welfare and Juvenile Justice, they don't really often have the same culture of doing that. We have a little bit less evidence in those areas. Two services that you'll see up there that warrant a little bit additional explanation. One of them is a no effect. This means, again, that we don't see negative effects associated with the program, but we actually don't see positive effects either. This service is cognitive behavioral therapy for kids with ADHD. Again, no negative effects, but no positive effects. And when we really dug into the research, what we found is that that therapy by itself has no effect. But really, those kids and those families need other supports. They need parental training, parental engagement. They need community supports and medication management. And when we bundle those things together, we actually find some programs that are proven effective that use CBT as one component of treatment. So that's a no effect. The other one in there is an inconclusive effect. In 3.5 years of research, we've never used this designation before. It's just a reminder that science and research is hard. But essentially what we found for this service is that there are a bunch of good studies. Some of them show positive impacts. Some of them show no impacts. And some of them, in fact, show harmful impacts on some outcome measures. And that is adding antidepressants to psychotherapy for kids with depression. The research right now is inconclusive on it. The body says we need additional research to be able to know whether this works. Therapy works, psychotherapy works, but adding antidepressants, the research is out still. So, in addition to doing what we're talking about, the inventorying and the providing of information about effectiveness, I just want to touch briefly on one other service that we do, and that's doing benefit-cost analyses. It's not the main thrust of this conversation, so I don't want to spend a lot of time here. You guys are very familiar with benefit cost numbers. I'm sure you get brought them on a daily basis. I'll talk a little bit about how we do our work. One of the things that I think is really important about benefit cost analyses, right, is that evidence-based policy, as Laura's alluded to, is just a research design. It shows that it's effective. It does not show the magnitude of the effect or the costs of the program. We're able to show the magnitude of the effect and the cost of the program through benefit cost analyses, and that gets us to cost effectiveness. So that's why this is additional tool is more difficult, but it's also really, really useful to have this information. It is more difficult, so we have 68 services in children's mental health for which we have in our inventory. We only are able to do benefit cost analyses for 7 of those services. The bar of evidence is very, very high. Essentially, it needs to be in the statistical model that we use, which I'm not going to go into great depth about because we're already getting pretty wonky in this conversation. But if we have questions, we're happy to address those. As you can see on our sheet, right, benefit cost analyses, we know you have a dollar in, you're going to get X dollars back. In this hypothetical, it's $2 back.
And Mr. Merrick, I think that we, in fact, don't really use cost-benefit very much around here. I think most of us are not that familiar with it. I mean, just not to change your presentation here, but just looking at your slide, when you have things like avoided health care costs and so on, when we get a fiscal note, we explicitly do not get that kind of analysis. So, you know, just to kind of put that out there, that as we move forward, to the degree that Results First can give us cost-benefit analysis, I think it could be very helpful. But anyway, continue.
The great point, Chair. I appreciate that. And absolutely, we appreciate that the legislature funded the ability for us to do this benefit cost analyses and very much want you all to use it. Going a little bit into kind of what that breakout is, the denominator, of course, is cost. We think about Minnesota-specific cost and Minnesota-specific benefits. So that's kind of the universe we're looking at. We don't care about the federal benefits from MA that are coming in. We ignore those costs. We don't care about the federal benefits if a kid is better off and has less health care costs or has higher tax revenue, but that goes to the feds. We ignore that. We ignore any benefits for kids that, you know, receive the treatment in Minnesota but earn tax revenue in Wisconsin 10 years down the line. We ignore that stuff. We're just talking about Minnesota when we do this. And it's really important in a benefit cost analysis as well that we understand that numerator. What is in the benefit profile? What are we monetizing? And so for the case of children's mental health, what we're able to monetize with our statistical model is decreased health care costs associated with decreased symptoms of mental illness for, say, PTSD or behavioral disorder. Increases in labor market earnings. This happens because kids are more likely to graduate from high school. We actually also see increasing costs for both the participant and the state associated with higher education. More kids are likely to go to college. It's a great thing, but there is a cost associated with that. And so that is factored into the numerator of the model. We also see just a small amount of decreased costs associated with crime. But by far the biggest thing in that numerator is future tax earnings, both tax revenues to the state and earnings for those families and those participants. Now, you all could think of tons of things that are not in that numerator. You know, we have parents that are less stressed out. That's going to have health consequences. You could have families that are staying together. That's meaningful, but we can't monetize that. You could have decreased impacts in our children's welfare system. We don't monetize that. We don't have the research to be able to do it. You could also have things like health parity, fairness, equity, justice, and innovation. We don't monetize those things. Those are other public values that are critical for this committee to consider and always do. But those are things that we can advise you on. So we are very limited in what we're able to physically monetize, and we try to be explicit about what's in that numerator.
Great. And let me stop you there because Representative Grunhagen had a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just want to thank you, Mr. Merrick. Correct?
Yes, sir.
For bringing up the psychotropic drugs use on children. I think you're the first person who's done that and that there's no real incriminating evidence that it actually works since I've been up here at the state legislature. It was a pet peeve of mine when I was on the school board for 16 years, and I took a strong stance against it, primarily because labeling and drugging these children has severe consequences, which I won't go into here. I've mentioned them before at different committees. And it's basically subjective. It's a judgment call. There's nothing that shows up in an X-ray. And we got, I don't know how many different labels we put on these children, and you might as well brand them with it because it stays with them the rest of their life. They also have great difficulty in getting into the military if they're on psychotropic drugs past 12 years old. So thank you for bringing up the subject. I hope that if this committee deals with it in some way, that we look at ways to minimize this, as other countries have, because we're doing it excessively in our country and especially in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
And so thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Mayor, this might be a good opportunity for you to maybe sort of talk about the what exactly your analysis shows and what it doesn't show, maybe using that example that you just talked about and that Representative Grunhagen has kind of extended it to a lot of other circumstances, I think.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Chair, for the question clarification. Yeah, we would say that it's an inconclusive impact, and so the research right now is saying that we need more evidence, and when we've read the evidence, and of course this isn't us saying it, this is us relying on high quality, we call them meta-analyses. What they do is they take a bunch of studies together and look at them at a whole, and inside of those meta-analyses we find very, very mixed results. And so from our standpoint, the research is telling us that we could use more evidence in this place.
So, Mr. Mayor, I think, though, that Representative Grunhagen, and correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of talking about a much broader range of perhaps interventions with different kinds of he's talking about psychotropic medication and perhaps a bunch of different circumstances. And what you're talking about here that's inconclusive is kind of a very specific circumstance that's been studied. Could you address that?
Yeah. In children's mental health, well, for anything, we need to think of for whom this is effective. In this specific case, the research is about antidepressants in addition to therapy for kids with depression. So that's the case. That's the whom. We are not speaking in other circumstances.
Right. And so if I could just continue that. So there might be more, there might be other research that you do or other things you analyze that go more to his question or more to different pieces of his question, but this is just a kind of a narrow examination. Is that accurate?
This is just one service.
Okay. And I'll go back to Representative Grunhagen and then it'll be Hamilton.
Oh,
yes.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Yeah, I just one additional follow-up comment. One of the things I've observed being in, you know, elected official now for, I hate to count the years, to tell you the truth, is that especially in government, when there's money tied to a particular activity, it's very difficult to get accurate information on that because the stakeholders that are receiving that money through the government programs, whatever it might be, in this case, labeling and drugging psychotropic drugs on our children, seem to not want to see the real evidence come to the surface. So to the degree that you can help us see this, even in a narrow area, I would sincerely appreciate it, and I'm sure the thousands of children labeled drugged in this state would appreciate it and their parents. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. That's kind of what all this is about, actually. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, is there a defined length of time or an acceptable length of time where a program will be in the defined as theory-based before you finally say it's no effect or proven harmful?
Ms. Kramer?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton. The way we've looked at that so far is just, is there any research coming out on it? So until that research has taken place, we're going to continue to call it theory-based. So we would not, absent a high-quality study saying it has no effect, we wouldn't move it into that category just because a lot of time has elapsed. In terms of timing and research, I think we see sort of a lot of variation in you know, how long it takes for a program to be evaluated. And I think it varies not just by program but also by subject area. As Weston mentioned, you know, some of the more clinically based types of program areas, like mental health, like substance use, they're more used to doing this kind of research. So you see research come out a lot more quickly, and you see replication of it. So you'll see, you might look up a particular treatment and see 15 or 20 really high quality studies. Whereas if you're looking at you know, maybe a parent support program that's tied to child welfare involved families. That's something that's maybe gone on for 20 years and nobody has taken the time or had the resources to study it.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when you first mentioned 46%, I think, were in the theory based, my initial reaction was, one, how many dollars are tied to that 46%, right? And would we be better off finding a different solution? And so I guess that's kind of the basis of my question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
So our thought on theory based is always we should explore it. There's a lot of cases where theory-based, and actually I would say everything at some point has been theory-based. So we never want to be in the world where we're at 100% evidence-based or even close to it because we want to allow innovation to occur. And to be honest, studying things is hard. It's really difficult. It takes time and resources to do these types of studies. And so I think naturally over time we'll see fewer and fewer things that are theory-based. We never want to get close to that. And there are some times where it is just inappropriate to study something in this way, in this mechanism, and so we need to be cautious of those situations as well. The thing that I will add is we do our very best to understand the percent of dollars, and we would love to show the percent of dollars, but it's almost impossible. I'll give just one brief example. There's a lot of reasons for that. Many of the reasons are we have a federal system of government where there's a lot of different funding streams, but just the way even that we bill in mental health, I'll take, for example, we don't bill cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a very proven practice, or multisystemic family therapy, which is a very proven practice. We bill psychotherapy, which is this big aggregate model. And so even inside of our medication management system, we cannot bill for evidence-based practices. And so we have no mechanism to see in a very clean way what's happening on the ground. So we're trying to do some things to understand what's going on the ground, but it's very hard for us to actually look at the administrative records to do so. I will point out that we don't have to do it like that. DHS bills, for example, an evidence-based practice called assertive community treatment. They bill directly for that practice. That's one instance whereby we know the exact amount of money that we spent in MA on assertive community treatment. So just the way our data system is structured, the way our federal government is structured, it's incredibly hard to know what we spent. We do our best, though.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions.
Please.
I think the first, I kind of want to respond to Representative Gruhagen, maybe not respond, but maybe add on to exactly what you're saying, because I agree with you, right? And I give an example. Like in the African-American community, often with our African-American boys in our educational system, we see a group of them funneled into special education in really, really high numbers, because they're active, they can't sit still, things are going on, trauma and stuff is happening, right? And then once they are funneled into special ed, they are given medication for ADD, ADHD, because someone has diagnosed them, right? And what happens with that is that they never get onto a pathway of success, right? And so we as legislators who are making decisions about how we're going to create better educational outcomes for kids don't look at more of maybe some evidence practices where I'm saying that, you know, kids who are been diagnosed in that way may need more one-on-ones, you know, one-on-one attention, you know, in interaction with teachers or a paraprofessional or a social worker, or having a playroom where they'd be, when you see a child's about to explode, you take them out and take them to a playroom so that they can run around or hit on things in a room by themselves, or just have parent support in a different way. And so I really appreciate, you know, having results first here, because we got to get results. Amen. Right? And in so many ways, we are spending so, so much money, and we're getting worse outcomes. And so this helps us to look at how do we look at evidence-based practices or some best practices so that we can get the results that we want, so that we are not putting the burden so often on our state to take care of individuals and families and of the ills of the world, right? So that's a statement.
Yeah, and I'll call on Representative Grunhagen again in a sec, but I just want to say, Representative Moran, I appreciate that. there's a lot that we do, that we fund, where we really are kind of flying blind. And what Results First is telling us, you know, they haven't studied everything. We're not going to have good evidence for everything. But what we do have, I'm hoping that we can begin to use it. So, you know, we're having to make difficult choices all the time around here. And the best, just having the best evidence there is in front of us, I hope will help us to prioritize. And as we go forward and there's more evidence for more things and we know about it, that we'll get better and better at this. So I just want to, I don't want to overpromise or leave the impression that they're overpromising.
Madam Chair,
we're kind of in the infancy of this, but I totally take your point.
I think and I totally agree with you. So I think we're saying the same thing.
Thank you.
The second question that, so I'm on page 3, slide 5, looking at Result First projects. And so one of the projects is the child welfare system, which is huge.
Right.
This is like really huge. Can you be a little bit more specific about what area within child welfare system that you have projects or what you're looking at in that area?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Kramer?
Madam Chair, Representative Morant, for that project, we looked specifically at programs and services that had at least a primary goal of reducing child maltreatment and reducing out-of-home care placements. So that was sort of the way that we scoped that. That one gets a little bit tricky in terms of, you know, when you think about prevention, how far upstream are you going? And, you know, because that can get really big and that can extend, you know, across generations. And so generally, I would say the bulk of that project was looking at child welfare involved. And then we sort of took what I would maybe call the first, you know, the first level of prevention. So looking at home visiting kinds of programs. And some of that. So still targeted prevention as opposed to like a more broad primary prevention.
Okay. Are you able to, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Are you able to share with the committee maybe some of the projects or practices that you believe are yielding some positive results for families?
Ms. Kramer?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, absolutely. We'd be happy to provide that. And, in fact, something that we're going to be talking about later in the presentation, I don't know if we'll get to it or not, is we're actually doing some pretty extensive work right now within that space, given the federal Family First legislation that was passed last February and is providing funding incentives for evidence-based practices in the child welfare space. And so what we're trying to understand on the heels of the Results First project is, okay, if we know that these evidence-based practices exist somewhere in Minnesota, where do they exist, who's offering them, what's their capacity to deliver, would they need to expand services? So we actually have surveys that are out right now to about 800 licensed providers and to all counties where we're working to gather that information. So in addition to just providing some information on which programs and services have been found to be effective, we'd also be happy to share that information as it becomes available.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
Representative Moran,
because this is important to me, right? This is like really, really important to me. And I know within the Health and Human Policy Committee, this is something that we're going to take a stab at because there are some evidence-based practices through a strength-based lens that we can be using, right, to really keep kids safe but strengthen children and families and communities. And so I would like to see some of the things you're talking about with some of the things that I also know has been utilized across the state. Mm-hmm.
We'd be happy to provide some follow-up information.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to say briefly is I agree with Representative Moran's comments about minority students and labeling and drugging 100%, okay? And I think they're disproportionately affected negatively by these practices without any or little evidence. Most of it's subjective. The other thing I'd say is that if – it comes before this committee to give a raise to Ms. Kramer and Mr. Merrick, I will vote for a raise. They're actually trying to do something that helps, okay? Just for the record.
And just for the record, I would note that Representative Grunhagen doesn't know what they're being paid now.
For the record, I think I'm supposed to decline.
Madam Chair is correct again.
Anyway, thank you. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. No, this is an important thing, and as I said at the outset, I hope that we're going to, you know, make better use of what they're offering, because I do think it's going to be really valuable for us, even if it can't answer every question. So please continue.
Yeah, we're actually, to make sure that we respect the committee's time, we're going to skip through that slide, which is the actual benefit cost analysis, one of them. This report will be released next week, and all of the previous reports, information inventories, benefit cost analyses, reports that are way too long than you'll never have time to read are up on our website, and Laura will be pointing to that in a second.
Okay, and Representative Loeffler wanted to make a comment or ask.
Yeah, I just actually wanted to follow up on a question that was actually going to be about the slide we're not going to go through. But it goes to the topic that they just went through, which is, you know, when you're looking at benefit cost ratios, yeah, they tend to look really long-term, like lifetime earnings and, you know, success. And we want long-term wonderful outcomes for the people that we serve. But we have to balance budgets that are really short term. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I hope that in the future you'll be willing to look at is the idea of breaking down these findings into short term and long term, yeah, so that we can actually start to get fiscal notes that show the benefit of these investments, because our fiscal note process tends to be fiscally conservative. And even if we have some evidence that this will reduce readmissions, this will reduce in a short period of time, where we have a hard time getting those translated into the fiscal notes that we need to use to balance our budget. And so I'm hoping that as this continues to evolve, that we'll be able to offer more insight into the actual budget process as we try and get more and more of this evidence-based processes implemented.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Okay, let's try to plow through this. Sorry for all the talk here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, this is a good conversation. So now that we have you excited about evidence, which we get really excited about on a daily basis, want to give you some tools to think about, you know, if you have a policy question or a constituent comes to you and has an idea and you want to, you find yourself asking and being curious, what does the evidence say? What do you do, in short? And so we want to give you a couple of tools to sort of empower you to go out and find evidence in ways that you don't need to have studied it and such that some of us have, and you can still make really good use of it. That said, you know, our office continues to be available and to answer questions and help guide you through that process as needed, too. So one of the first things that I want to point out is that through all of the different results first projects that we've done, we have identified over 420 services that are offered in Minnesota and are publicly funded in some way. And so what we did really over the summer was spent some time and aggregated them into one database that's searchable. And this database includes things that are currently offered in Minnesota and what the evidence says about any of those things. So again, this sort of compiles about 3 years of research from across the state, and it looks at a total of about 17 different types of outcomes. And this is, I'm going to walk through just sort of a couple of examples of how this is a tool that could be helpful for you to use at some point in the future. So again, this is what we call the Minnesota inventory, and I'm just going to go ahead and pull it up here for you. Yeah, if you want to do that. So this is a tool that's really meant to sort of plug and play and search. And so we have a lot of different filters here. But let's say, for example, that you're interested in identifying programs that could be offered that would reduce alcohol use in youth. And you kind of want to know what's, you know, you have this idea, you want to know what's out there in Minnesota right now, what are we already doing? So you could come onto the tool, and essentially, you could search by outcome. So you would say, okay, I want to know about alcohol use and underage alcohol use. So you can click that filter on, and it takes a moment to think because we're going through all 423 of those. And we come down to 59 different programs that are offered in Minnesota right now that in some way are looking at reducing underage alcohol use. And so what we also have for each one of these then, so you can hover over it, you can get a description of what that program is, and then you can look at this evidence rating. And what we'll show there is what the evidence has shown on a particular outcome. So in this case, for 12-step facilitation therapy, it's shown favorable outcomes in alcohol use and illicit drug use. You might also come across one where maybe it hasn't studied a certain outcome, or maybe there's neutral effects on a particular outcome. So it can kind of vary depending on what program you're looking at. But when there's evidence available, we also provide the link out to a clearinghouse so that you could go and pull more information. Look for, if you were so inclined, you could look at the studies to see what they actually say. But you can get kind of more detail. This is really intended to be kind of a first place to start, and then can kind of dive deeper more as you would like to be able to. So that's kind of one way to use this. Another way might be, you know, maybe a constituent comes to you with a particular program in mind. And, you know, they're saying, well, I work a lot with children who are involved in the juvenile justice system and the child welfare system. And I've read about this crossover youth program. It's available in a couple of counties, and I'd like to talk about what it means to expand it. So what you could then do in that scenario is come over here and actually search for that particular program. So if we were to put in crossover youth programming, go ahead and search that, then what it'll pull up is what we found through our different projects, both our juvenile justice and child welfare project, about crossover youth programming. So this particular example is one that's theory-based. So there hasn't been any research that meets that level that we sort of lay out on this program yet. However, when you hover over the sources of evidence, we have other expert opinions in here. And so this is an example of a program where there has been some evaluation done. It's just not meeting that sort of treatment and control style that we need in order to say something's proven effective. So we still want to know that we know there's some work out there already, right? So if somebody's saying, well, I know it's been studied and, you know, it's proven to work, this is sort of a way to say, oh, okay, there is some evidence on it. But it wasn't that causal evidence that they were talking about. So it can kind of give you a sense of what's actually happening in that scenario.
Thank you. Representative Moran had a question. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 10 on slide 20, you talk about the combined inventory that pulls together some evidence, and then you talk about the 3 years of research. And so I think that's something that maybe we should talk a little bit more about, too, because often, you know, depending on who's in the majority or the minority, we change things, we implement something, we pass a law, someone comes back in, we say it doesn't work, and it's not working, let's do something else. But in order to get some really evidence and some research around anything, most things, it takes at least 3 years of some data collection or some data collection. Is that what you have found, or?
Yeah, so yeah. I think this really brings a very important, thank you, Chair. This brings a really important question to the front, and that is we are looking out at evidence that's already been done, evaluations that have already been done. So academics and other researchers, other states, both in Minnesota and across the country, have done these evaluations, and you're exactly right. They take 2 to 5 years, if not longer sometimes, to get those outcomes. What our project is able to do is then go point to those pieces of research that have been done already and pull them in. So Laura and I are very much on the ground talking to practitioners and providers and counties about what they know and see on the ground, and we pull that descriptive data together. But our team is not right now physically evaluating those programs with a treatment and control group. That would take a lot more than the 1.5 of us that we have.
Absolutely.
So we leverage the existing research that's out there.
Okay. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about accessibility of this information. I'm a library media specialist in a middle school, and one of my responsibilities is to teach, you know, the right resource process. And as you were going through your whole process, I'm like, wow, that is the scientific method that we teach our students. That's exactly it. You know, fact-based, evidence-based information when they're doing any kind of data collection and that sort of thing. And so my question is this available to the general public? Would this be something that I could link on my school's web page for students to go to? Oftentimes they have assignments where they have to pick an issue that's going on in our communities or in Minnesota, and oftentimes it's not that easy to find for them, or, you know, for me to take this amount of time to help them find that information, especially when it's current. It's already been tested for accuracy and evidence-based. Would this be something that we could direct our students to, as well as any constituent who might have questions like on what is Minnesota doing about such and such?
Ms. Kramer.
Madam Chair, yes is the short answer. This is publicly available out on MMB's website, so we do have a link in our materials here. Mm-hmm. And we've also, let's see, I'll sort of click over in another slide too. One of the things we've done is actually create a website to sort of lay out what, you know, what do we mean when we talk about evidence? What are some of the things that you should ask yourself? Because as you point out, and this is really important, you could go out and Google something and get one piece of information to support or refute whatever you're looking for. And so the goal of this is that we've gone and we've looked at the body in its entirety to say, on base, is this positive or negative? What does it look like? Mm-hmm. And so that's really, I think, a lot of the value that we see in this. And so that's part of why we wanted to put out on the public website and kind of give people tools to be able to use it and play around with it. And, you know, this is just sort of a first iteration, too.
I'll just add one thing.
Mr. Merrick.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually even training videos out there. Our manager put together some very nice webinars that if you ever need to fall asleep to, they're right there available to you. I will also add that we actually 2 years ago worked with middle school and worked through different policy proposals and evidence-based, and had them look on our clearinghouse to see if they could figure out evidence-based practices. So I really respect the work that you guys are doing as librarians. It was a really fun process.
Right. So, I'm going to call on Representative Hamilton, and then we're going to quick wrap up the presentation. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is very interesting. My question is, have you, since you started, has there been any programs defined as proven harmful? If so, how many, and can you give us an example?
Great question. Ms. Kramer?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, yes. And I was just going to pull back up that visual that we have, because we actually have the number of them. But one example that comes to mind, yeah, if you don't mind pulling that, is DARE. And so that is a program that I know I went through when I was in middle school, drug abuse resistance education. That was found to be no effect. And so that is something that we've seen sort of an evolution on. So as the program creators saw that research come in, they changed their model, mm-hmm. rebranded it, and they have another version now. That's got kind of a...
It's called Keeping It Real.
Keeping It Real.
So they, yeah. They.
And now that's something that has evidence. Right. I was like, it's called something different. That does have evidence for effectiveness. An example of something that was proven harmful is a program in the juvenile justice system called Scared Straight. There was also a TV show made out of this. So the idea being that you bring a juvenile who's at risk or maybe had a low-level offense into a prison system and scare them from wanting to ever be part of it again. And what they found wasn't that they had better outcomes, but they actually tended to have much worse outcomes and recidivate.
Washington State did a benefit cost analysis, and a dollar into that program led to negative $119 back to the state.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
So we do find those. They're fewer and farther between, but they're absolutely out there, and there's a way actually on the inventory site to sort by anything that's a no effect or proven harmful. So you could target.
Thank you, Madam.
So if you could wrap up quickly here, that'd be great. Thank you so much, and because we do have another presentation.
Yep, absolutely. So I think there's a few more slides and resources in the paper materials that we've left for you, so you can certainly take a look at that. But I would just end in saying that, you know, we have a lot of resources available both through our team at MMB, but then there's just a lot that's out there. And so we hope that this is the beginning of a dialogue and that as you go through your work this session and beyond, that you're able to tap into some of this and not hesitate to work with us as you have questions.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. And just to note again for members that, you know, I intend to try to help push this along by basically requiring you, if you're bringing forward a bill, to check and see what's there. I'm not saying it has to meet any threshold or it has to have been studied or anything like that, but that you come into the committee and say, you know, kind of like the fiscal note piece that we don't have yet, we can kind of do that ourselves using that resource. You know, the evidence note to say, well, what does Results First have? Is this something they don't study? Is it something they found inconclusive or just what? And especially the resource of the survey. What are we already doing in Minnesota? If you're bringing some new thing, then you better be checking to see what are we already doing in Minnesota so that you can inform the committee of that. That's just all I'm trying to do, not be heavy-handed with anybody. Just ask you to give us information that's out there when you come in to present a bill. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
And Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm love the presentation. As again, I think a lot of us probably saw something on that screen. We wanted to pull up our program that we've been working on. As this pet in the past, so maybe my request is to our CA or CLA, was would you send each one of us a link to that so that we can look at something if it comes up? I will forget this when I walk out the door, and I just know that if it's emailed to me, that link, I will know that to put that in my favorites. But this is a really good one, and I appreciate the presentation, but I certainly have a couple projects I want to make sure if what I'm working is pushing water uphill or is it actually working. So thank you for this today. Appreciate
that's
the
great.
Link.
And Representative Baker, I know that we will do that. Thank you for the suggestion. I think it's in what you gave us here, too.
The one-pager, yes, Chair.
It's in the one-pager. Okay. Very good. So we've got it, and we will send it out so that members can just click on it. Thank you. So we're going to move on, and we're going to ask our House Research folks to try to finish up their presentation if they can. If we've left them enough time, I don't know, but we'll see. And I think that we have members, I hope you saved the paper copy of the slides from when they did their first presentation. Oh, there's another one. Oh, okay. Okay, well, Ms. Niedernhofer has put in another one for you, so if you didn't have it, you do now. So. So anytime you technology problems.
Madam Chair, members, Danielle Pinelli from House Research. I think we're going to be starting on slide 99. And I am going to be covering some of the issue areas that Sarah Sunderman would normally be covering when she's here. So hopefully I can go through those slides fairly quickly. And this is going to have to do with child support enforcement, child welfare, and fraud prevention. And then Ms. Clarkvist will go through Minnesota Department of Health programs and services.
Okay. And just you probably are aware, too, that we also had a presentation, a budget presentation from the Department of Health. So we we've probably got some background, and we can probably go through that fairly quickly. And members, we're on page 50 of the packet, slide 99.
Madam Chair, members, slide 99 relates to child support enforcement. What I'll say about this is that federal law requires each state to establish a child support enforcement program and sets broad standards and requirements for that program. The federal government then also provides federal temporary assistance to needy families funding and child support enforcement funding to states that meet the federal requirements. So Minnesota does have a program that meets the requirements, and then this slide also has just some information about funding and the amount of money that's collected, most of which is via income withholding. Next, we're going to move on to protection of children and vulnerable adults, and we're going to start with child welfare services. This is another program that's required by federal law. Each state is required to provide intervention and services to protect children from abuse and neglect. The legislature establishes the policy to implement the federal law and provide services to families so that their children are safe. Funding comes from a variety of sources, including federal, county, and state sources. And it's the counties that are actually responsible for providing child welfare services when a child is alleged to have been abused or neglected in the home. In statute, there is a Maltreatment of Minors Act that lays out who is required to investigate reports when there's been an alleged violation. And it kind of depends on if the violation is violation of criminal law, and also where the violation is alleged to have happened, if it's in a school, foster care, other facilities. There are different state agencies that are required to do the investigation. If a child is not safe in a home or a parent has not cooperated with a service plan, a county may file a child in need of protection or services or a CHIPS case. And if the home remains unsafe after the child has been in foster care for 11 months, then the county will file a permanency petition. There are various types of payments that foster care providers and then also children who have been adopted or are being cared for by a relative receive. This is all part of North Star Care for Children, and those payments are the North Star Foster Care Payment, North Star Kinship Assistance, and then North Star Adoption Assistance. There are also services for vulnerable adults. A vulnerable adult is defined as an individual who is age 18 or older and who is impaired physically, mentally, or emotionally and unable to protect themselves from maltreatment. It also includes residents or inpatients of a facility, people who receive certain outpatient services or receive certain home care services. And reports of suspected maltreatment must be made to a common entry point that is required to be available 24 hours a day to accept those reports. And it is counties, law enforcement, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Health that assess and investigate allegations of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. And then the counties provide protective services when needed.
Excuse me, a second, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wonder if Ms. Pennelly, in the child protection area, can talk a little bit. A few years back, following some cases across the state that were highlighted, some deaths of children within the child protection system, the state allocated additional resources to counties through some legislation. As a part of that, I've been visiting with some of the counties have been reaching out. As a part of the bill passed, there was a withhold amount of funding back to the counties for child protection services that's being withheld until the county meets certain benchmarks. Some of it is time from the moment that the complaint comes in to make sure that things are being handled in a timely fashion. And I know some of the counties, the challenge is the counties that are having trouble meeting those benchmarks are the counties that most need of the money that we withhold. And so I was wondering if you could cover, if you know off the top of your head, because I know it's not in your stuff, how the withhold works and what the percentage is on that. I'm trying to remember, and I can't off the top of my
head. Representative Zerwas, I don't know if maybe Mr. Berg knows that. No.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, I don't remember the percentage. We'd have to look back at it. As you recall, there was legislation last year that addressed this issue that would have swept that money and then reallocated it with some additional changes to the child protection system. So I don't know the percentage off the top of my head.
Yeah. Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, my phone-a-friend is telling me it's a 20% withhold. And so it's something that my county has approached with concern, although they have not had issues meeting the benchmarks, but I know it's an issue that the counties have raised and we'll probably continue to work on. So I just wanted to raise that to the committee's attention, especially for members that may not have been here the last 4 years.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Watts. Please continue. Oh, I'm sorry. I have another question. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the presenter, I just would like to get a more detailed definition of what a vulnerable adult is. I was reading through what you've stated here, and it looks like it could be anyone who's emotionally impaired. I understand the, you know, physically impaired or mentally impaired, but it says or emotionally impaired and unable to protect themselves. Does that mean someone, it's this elderly person living alone or on their own independently in their home? Or later in the definition, is it just anyone that's living in a nursing home, whether or not they're emotionally impaired? Or is it, do you have a kind of a numbers that you've looked at for how many vulnerable adults there would be in Minnesota that would fall into this category?
Can either of you answer that?
Madam Chair and Representative Sparkus. Munson, so this is the definition that's in the Vulnerable Adults Act in Section 626.5572. I would have to talk to folks at DHS and the Health Department, the state agencies that work in this area to find out more about what it means to be emotionally impaired and also to find out estimates of numbers. A person can be considered potentially a vulnerable adult just by being an inpatient or resident of a facility. It doesn't mean they are, but they can be subject to maltreatment in one of those settings.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, or maybe, Ms. Clarkvist, maybe to say better, subject to particular protections against maltreatment,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Madam.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Okay. Please continue.
Madam Chair, if there aren't any more questions on that section, we'll move to the program integrity and operations. And the first thing that we're going to talk about under this section is provider fraud prevention. It's the Office of Inspector General within the Department of Human Services that oversees fraud prevention and recovery efforts for all DHS-administered public programs. In recent years, DHS has implemented several different procedures and initiatives to reduce provider fraud and improper payments. You can see some of them listed here on slide 107. DHS also contracts with outside entities to conduct post-payment provider audits to identify and recover overpayments and identify underpayments. There are a couple of different things that the Department of Human Service does related to recipient fraud prevention. One is there's the Minnesota Restricted Recipient Program, in which recipients may be placed in this program after reviews show abuse or misuse of medical services. People who are placed in this program are restricted to one primary care provider, clinic, hospital, and pharmacy for up to 36 months. And this program has been shown to reduce costs by $5,000 to $6,000 per year per person, I believe. The state and counties work together to prevent public assistance fraud, and the state funds a county-administered program called the Integrity Reinvestment Project, which pays for preventing and investigating fraud in the state's cash assistance, child care, health care, and food programs. These programs are just meant to prevent and reduce improper payments by resolving eligibility questions for caseworkers. And this slide, 109, just shows for the year 2017 some statistics related to fraud investigations. And there's also a lot more information in the DHS 2017 annual report from the Office of the Inspector General, which I have here, and it's also on the Department of Human Services website, so I could send out the link to that if people are interested. The next thing I'm going to talk about is DHS program regulation. The Department of Human Services is responsible for licensing residential and non-residential programs for children and adults. There are approximately 20,000 programs and providers that held DHS licenses in 2017. Some licensing functions are delegated to the counties. For example, family child foster care, child foster care, adult foster care, and family child care licensing functions are all processed by counties, and those programs are monitored by the counties rather than the state.
Ms. Puniello, you have a question from Representative Baker?
Real quick, Madam Chair, back to 109. Pretty alarming, some of the investigations and some of the identifying what the fraud numbers turned out. We don't have time to go through a lot of that right now, but I'm wondering if we could get more than just 1 year there, if this committee could get maybe the last 5 or 10 years of that same type of work, so we can kind of see what type of things you're finding. So for another day, but I would like to just more than get 1 year.
Okay, thank you, Representative Baker. That's probably something we could ask from get from DHS. So we'll make a note of that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the Department of Human Services also is involved in investigating allegations of maltreatment of a child or a vulnerable adult. As I mentioned before, they also investigate allegations of licensing violations, and they also conduct background studies, which I will talk about on slide 111. DHS conducts background studies on all individuals who provide direct contact services to children or vulnerable adults to determine whether the individual has committed an act that would disqualify him or her from providing those services. And then background studies are also required for certain other people, such as guardians and conservators, people who provide foster care, people seeking adoption, and also people over the age of 13 living in a household where a licensed program is provided. Slide 112 just shows some more information about background studies. The background study system that the Department of Human Services uses is called NetStudy 2.0. It requires both a fingerprint and a photograph, and there are several different records that are searched, which are listed on this slide. This system provides electronic updates of a study subject's criminal records, and then it also provides an electronic notification to any updates to the employer. And then there are some statistics down at the bottom for 2017 about how many background studies were conducted and the number of disqualifications.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And I'm going to call on Representative Moran. We only have about five more minutes. So, Ms. Clark, this we might not really get too far in your part of the presentation, but Representative Moran.
Madam Chair, to the testifiers, on slide, I think, 109, under the fraud prevention investigations, it talks about the 582 open provider investigations. What would those providers have been? Were they like nursing homes, or what were they? Do you know?
Ms. Pugnelli?
Madam Chair, members, I don't know off the top of my head. I think it could have been any type of provider, you know, medical services, could have possibly been child care providers. I'm sure there's probably more information in this annual report from the Department of Human Services that I can send the link
Madam Chair.
To.
Yeah, Representative Moran.
So I just wanted to just point out that it also talked about the 67 child care providers at the bottom. So I'm making an assumption that included in those 582 other providers, they were not child care providers.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, I don't know without looking through this report.
Okay. Madam, right. So my hope is that because for some clarity reasons, because I know we are having this big conversation around child care providers and whether or not we're going to withhold CCAP increases and reimbursement rates and things like that. But we have, you know, that's like $219,000 that we was able to recoup. But we look at the other 582 providers, that's like $12 million. And I think, you know, if we're going to really look at savings and frauds, I think we need to expand this beyond just looking at child care providers and look at a bigger picture here. So I would like to, if it's possible, find out who those other providers were.
Right. Thank you, Representative Moran. And I think that's really important context information that the committee should definitely have. And I just had a meeting with the Inspector General, Carolyn Hamm, and, you know, talked about some of this generally. And they do, you know, this is obviously any fraud is serious fraud, but the money is probably in other places, more of the money, I should say. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, so we'll have some of that context as we move forward. Thank you. So let's see. We are at the beginning of Ms. Barkvist's section, I think, right? And we did just hear from the Health Licensing Board, so we probably could skip that part. Ms. Barkvist, I'm sorry to do this to you, but is there a section of this that you – I don't know if you were here for our presentation with the Department of Health. So is there anything that you – think that would be helpful to the committee that maybe wasn't covered by the commissioner? Because I know that it all goes by pretty fast.
So, Madam Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research, and I would say that a lot of what I can talk about was covered by the Health Department. This is just kind of provided in a slightly different format.
Okay. So maybe... that being the case, and we just have a couple of minutes, are there any questions for maybe for Ms. Clarkvist? Because she actually does work with the Health Department. Scott, Ms. Pugnelli was representing someone else's area, but you do have the health the House Research person here. Representative Neuer.
Madam Chair, just wanted to inquire about the background studies. If someone's record has been expunged after a couple of years or many years, what happens to the background study? Will that individual be disqualified from doing any services for DHS?
Ms. Clarkvist, can you answer that? Or
so, Madam Chair and Representative Neuer, that is not something I can answer. I'd have to talk to the background study people at DHS to find that out.
Yeah, but
I'm happy to do that.
Thank you, and Representative Neuer, I think that. That section is for the researcher who's on parental leave, I think.
Yes.
And she'll be back Not soon enough for us.
In two weeks, right.
We're all counting the days.
But who's counting?
I'm sure she's counting the days, too. But we could get more of that information, too, for you.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Okay. So seeing no further questions, just thank you all. I think that was a good discussion, and thank you all for your attention. And for today, we are.